without any help from any of the other governments or even the people. General masses, as they come to know the role of Iran in the world, you know, let's say destruction of ISIS, which was at the hands of the divine system, they appreciate what Iran is doing, but the despots and tyrants, they don't like it. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
As China's capabilities match and inevitably surpass those of the US military, Washington will find itself pushed out of the Indo-Pacific region, and its status as the world's so-called superpower will have been erased. We now present you an article written by Brandon J. Weichert, the author of Winning Space, How America Remains a Superpower. The piece is titled America Losing the Future to China. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. Please stay with us for more of Brandon J. Weichert's article. Few Americans realize it, but their country's dominance in high technology innovation is now in question. This is something that Google's former chief executive officer, Eric Schmidt, acknowledged in his recent testimony before US Congress. Meanwhile, Elon Musk, a business magnate, industrial designer, and engineer, has stated that China will become the world's premier economy and world power, in large part because of Beijing's consistent investment in high-technology innovation. Whether it be artificial intelligence or space technology, China is rapidly becoming a dominant player in high-technology development. As these trends intensify over the next decade, China's military superiority over the United States will naturally increase as well. For example, at the end of February, China surprised Western intelligence services with the sudden launch of a trio of Yuagan 331 satellites. As U.S. Senator Gary Peters, a Democratic member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, noted, this was the third launch since 31st of January, a clear indication that China's capabilities are rapidly catching up with those of the United States. As China's capabilities match and inevitably surpass those of the U.S. military, Washington will find itself pushed out of the Indo-Pacific region, and its status as the world's so-called superpower will have been erased. The Yaogan constellation was inaugurated in 2006 with the launch of China's first synthetic aperture radar satellite for constant all-weather imaging of the Earth. Just a year later, the constellation's first optical satellite was deployed. By 2009, the first trio of Yaogan electronic reconnaissance satellites were added to the growing constellation. Most experts believe that the Yaogan satellite constellation is akin to the U.S. Naval Ocean Surveillance System. These satellites intercept radio signals from the ground and use them to triangulate and track the position of warships at sea. This is an essential evolution in China's growing naval and space capabilities. Yaogan will allow China's rapidly modernizing military to monitor increasingly vulnerable American military units operating near China. The key strategic aim for China is to deter U.S. military intervention into the Indo-Pacific. The Yaogan satellite constellation's ability to track and target U.S. naval assets is essential for China's growing anti-access area denial strategy. In fact, Beijing has taken extraordinary steps to protect the Yaogan constellation itself from American anti-satellite attack. In 2018, for example, a small co-orbital satellite was deployed alongside one of the surveillance satellites of the Yaogan constellation. No one knows what the co-orbital satellite's mission was. My colleague, Brian Cho, has nicknamed these co-orbital satellites space stalkers. In peacetime, these tiny and maneuverable systems can be used to repair larger satellites remotely. However, in wartime, they can be fashioned into devastating space weapons. Space stalkers could serve as bodyguards for sensitive satellites like those in the Yaogan constellation. These bodyguards could deflect American anti-satellite attack against satellites belonging to the Yaogan constellation. This would keep the Yaogan constellation operating in a war with the United States, increasing China's military superiority over the U.S. military forces in the Indo-Pacific region. Many American strategists believe that as China becomes more reliant on satellites over the next decade, the U.S. armed forces will be able to hold China hostage by threatening these vulnerable satellite constellations. Yet the presence of space stalkers among sensitive Chinese satellite constellations indicates an added layer of protection that American systems otherwise lack. Therefore, deterrence will be difficult to impose from Washington, and China will still possess an asymmetrical advantage. China needs systems like the Yaogan satellite constellation to keep the U.S. military just over the horizon in the Indo-Pacific. The harder it is for the United States to deploy forces reliably to fight Chinese forces in the South or East China Seas, the greater the advantage Beijing enjoys over Washington. Yet China's growing military capabilities have only occurred because the United States prematurely surrendered in the race for high technology development. As David P. Goldman outlines in his recent book, while the United States has grown complacent, Beijing has identified key strategic industries that they want China to capture. By capturing high-technology fields like those of quantum computing, space technology, biotechnology, or artificial intelligence, China will become the center of the world. Once China is a source of innovation for the new industrial revolution, its military will naturally grow in capabilities. Beijing could force fundamental changes to the international order that has long favored America. With each new development, China's strategic military superiority over the United States grows. Over time, as per Beijing's design, the balance of power will shift in China's favor, and that balance is unlikely to shift back to the United States, as China becomes the center of the new high-technology industrial revolution. America must create a long-term strategy for high-technology research and development before China leapfrogs the United States technologically over the next decade, not only becoming the world's largest economy, but eventually surpassing the U.S. military. If a federal research and development strategy is not developed and implemented soon, the United States will lose the future to China, just as both Eric Schmidt and David Goldman fear. As Donald Rumsfeld, the former U.S. Defense Secretary, once said, "We are on notice, but we have not noticed." Here's to hoping Washington notices soon.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Facebook has once again shut down the page of Press TV News Network, this time permanently, in yet another attack by the U.S.-based social media giant on Iranian media outlets. Facebook said in a note that this decision is irreversible. The company attempted to shut down Press TV's account without giving any prior warning. Facebook justified the act by claiming that Press TV has failed to follow the Facebook community standards. However, the company did not specify the so-called violations of its rules. The social media platform has, on a number of occasions, attacked Press TV, despite its own claim of providing space for freedom of expression. One such attack took place in mid-January, when Facebook temporarily deleted Press TV's page, which had more than 4 million followers. The news outlet, however, had its page restored after appealing the platform's decision to remove it. The attack coincided with Press TV's coverage of post-election violence in the U.S. Press TV has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship, not just on Facebook, but also on other fronts, including Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Over the past years, Facebook, along with other mentioned companies, have repeatedly targeted Press TV, among other media outlets of Iran, and the countries critical of the West and the Israeli regime's occupation of Palestine. It appears that the UK has also followed the footsteps of the US when it comes to censoring media. The UK broadcast regulator Ofcom recently stripped the Chinese media company of operating on its cable network, an exact move that it did to Iran's Press TV back in 2012.
I think we need to recognize that in today's day and age, the various social media, in particular we're talking about Facebook today, is being weaponized in the tools of the Western powers to actually try and make sure that the agendas that Western powers have are going to be promoted, and anyone that is resisting or saying different things to what the Western powers want to hear and want other people to hear outside they're going to try and make sure that those voices are suppressed.
In June 2020, Facebook labeled Iran's Press TV, Russia's Sputnik, and China's Xinhua news agency as state media, saying that it would block them from running advertisements in the U.S., which views the three countries as its arch enemies. The state media labels did not apply to the BBC, Deutsche Welle, or other government-funded Western news agencies, nor to those accounts funded by the U.S. government, such as Radio Free Europe. That is a clear case of double standards. Facebook had in 2018 targeted hundreds of accounts that it claimed were tied to Iran and Russia under the pretext of fighting misinformation campaigns. While American social media platforms do not hesitate to silence the voice of Iranian media under the pretext of policy violations, they offer a free hand to anti-Muslim hate groups and Iranophobes under the banner of freedom of expression and a blatant double standard policy.
I think the idea of freedom of speech within the Western world is something that has been promoted by the Western powers, and it's a myth. When you look at the detail of what's actually going on in terms of what people are able to articulate and the parameters within which they're actually allowed to operate, what you see is that whatever the flavor of the month is, whatever the fashion is in terms of the political fashion about what should and should not be said, then if anyone goes outside of those parameters or criticizes things that are outside of those parameters that Western powers want to have criticized, and they will not allow that.
Facebook and other Western social media networks have repeatedly attacked Iranian news networks like Press TV and Hispan TV, yet their allegations have been baseless. Therefore, there's a clear case of double standards. Western media cannot stand those who are critical of their policies, those who speak the truth, and of those who are the voice of the voiceless, as Press TV's slogan goes.
Friday, thousands of Yemenis rallied across the country to show their support for the popular Ansarullah movement and reiterate their strong resistance in the face of the devastating Saudi-led military campaign as the Yemen war entered its seventh year. People from all walks of life gathered in Sabine Square in central Sana'a since the early hours of Friday morning, waving the red, white, and black national flags. They chanted slogans against Saudi Arabia, which leads the military coalition against Yemen, and denounced U.S. support for it. Yemenis say the seventh year of the war will mark a departure from the rest, as the army has ramped up its retaliatory attacks against Saudi targets and made significant advances against Saudi-backed mercenaries. The recent spate of attacks seems to have had an impact on Saudi's policy in Yemen. Last week, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud presented a so-called peace initiative to end the conflict in Yemen, which would include reopening Sana'a's airport and allowing fuel and food imports through Hodeidah port, both of which are under the control of Ansarullah movement. The Ansarullah movement, however, dismissed the plan as fruitless unless the war ends and the years-long siege in Yemen is lifted.
It does appear that Saudi Arabia is attempting to withdraw. It has lost, of course, significant support from the United States for its war effort. So the fact that it has requested another ceasefire, although this is one that has been mentioned in the past unsuccessfully, but the fact they're bringing it up again at this time does indicate that Saudi Arabia sees that it is in a never-ending war that it cannot win.
Yemen says it will press on with its attacks until the other side puts an end to its aggression.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
The announcement raised hopes that Saudi hostilities against Yemen would end soon, but even that couldn't stop the Saudis from keeping up their onslaught on the war-ravaged country. While former U.S. President Donald Trump maintained close relationships with Saudi officials, including Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and provided Riyadh with abundant support, his predecessor, Barack Obama, wasn't free from blame either, as the Yemen war broke out during his administration when Joe Biden was serving as the vice president. Saudi Arabia, backed by the U.S. and its other regional allies, launched a devastating military campaign on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing Riyadh-backed former president Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi's government back to power and crushing the popular Ansarullah movement. That goal has not been fulfilled thanks to the resistance put up by Ansarullah throughout 6 years of indiscriminate war and blockade. What Saudi Arabia assumed to be a short conflict turned to an all-out war, killing hundreds of thousands and displacing millions.
The U.S. has always been as guilty as the Saudis because it has supported the war. It has provided Saudi Arabia with billions of dollars of weaponry, which has been used to slaughter the Yemeni people. This has continued. The United States has withdrawn some of the sales that it has made to Saudi Arabia, but it continues with some others. So it isn't as if it has stopped the flow of weapons to Saudi Arabia, weapons that that country is using to attempt to destroy Yemen. So the United States is complicit in this, as it has been from the start. This is nothing new, just because it's a new administration. The Biden administration mirrors the policies in this regard of the Trump administration, of the Obama administration, of the Clinton, Bush, going all the way back decades. The United States is a war-making and war-mongering nation. It supports wars of its allies if it will in some way enhance its profits and power throughout the world. This hasn't changed with Biden. It won't change with Biden. It's tragic, but the Yemeni people are continuing to fight and will until they are free.
Observers believe the Biden administration can only show its seriousness in ending the conflict by placing additional pressure on the Saudis to cease the violence and seek a diplomatic solution. Whether or not the U.S. is willing to do that to its regional ally is anybody's guess.
Israel appears to be in the midst of another political deadlock after its fourth general election in less than 2 years. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's become Israel's longest-serving prime minister after 12 years in power, had hoped that this week's election would give him another term. He tried hard to unite a right-wing coalition behind him, but apparently that has not happened. The 71-year-old's right-wing bloc has once again failed to secure enough votes for a parliamentary majority. His bloc is 9 seats short of a necessary 61-seat threshold. It is now far from clear who would get the mandate to form the next cabinet. If he wants to stay in power, Netanyahu will probably have to build a coalition involving Jewish ultra-Orthodox and ultra-nationalist parties. Netanyahu may even have to seek the support of a Palestinian party, which in a surprise development has managed to win several seats. Meanwhile, Netanyahu's opponents, who could somehow reach a parliamentary majority, are far from united and are unlikely to be able to agree to cooperate. It is still too soon to know whether this election will prove to be inconclusive. If neither bloc succeeds, Israel could be headed for a fifth general election since 2019. Some analysts believe the regime is experiencing its worst political crisis in decades. The Israeli Prime Minister is in deep trouble because this week's election was widely viewed as a referendum on his leadership. Netanyahu's election campaign focused on his much-talked-about COVID-19 vaccination program and his push to normalize ties with some Arab states. But his opponents insist he mishandled the pandemic. Meanwhile, they argue that he should not remain in office while being tried on corruption charges. Netanyahu is the first incumbent Israeli prime minister to be indicted after being formally charged with corruption. He has denied any wrongdoing and insists that he will not try to block the trial. But critics are not buying that. They suspect that if he finally forms a parliamentary majority, he may seek action at the Knesset to delay or end the legal process.
If he can form a coalition government, he will certainly appoint someone as the Attorney General who will quash the corruption charges against him. So, I mean, this is this is also, it's not simply it's not simply the question of forming a government for him. It's a question for him of staying out of prison, because let's face it, Israeli police have been after him for some time, and they have enough evidence.
Meanwhile, as Israeli political parties wrangle over how to proceed from this point, Palestinians in the occupied territories are showing less interest in Israeli politics. This is perhaps because the Palestinian issue was not mentioned much during electoral campaigns by Israeli parties. The regime has been demolishing Palestinian homes, seizing their lands, and building on them over the past decades.
We're going to continue to see exactly what we have been seeing over the past years, and that is the continuation of a settlement expansion, the ousting of Palestinians from East Jerusalem, the continued dispossession of the Bedouin in the Negev.
This has been an unchanging policy, and no new cabinet is expected to halt that.
Back in 2018, Jamal Khashoggi, a journalist and critic of the Saudi government, was murdered after he entered Saudi Arabia's consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Saudi Arabia initially denied any knowledge of Khashoggi's fate, as the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told Bloomberg News that the journalist left the consulate shortly after he entered and that there is nothing to hide. However, recordings and other evidence gathered by Turkish authorities revealed how a team of Saudi agents subdued, killed, and then dismembered the journalist inside the diplomatic mission. In February, a long-awaited U.S. intelligence report also concluded that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman approved and probably ordered the assassination of Khashoggi. But Washington stopped short of targeting bin Salman with financial or other sanctions. The report released in June 2019 by the UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard concluded that there was credible evidence that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other senior officials were behind Khashoggi's assassination, and called the murder an international crime. Lately, Calamard has revealed she was threatened by the Saudis for her role in the Khashoggi investigation. She said a colleague alerted her that a Saudi official had threatened to have her taken care of. The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary, and Arbitrary Killings says the officials in the room had considered the remarks as a death threat. Calamard, who will this month take on her new post as the Secretary General of Amnesty International, had previously slammed the international community for their failure to ensure justice in Khashoggi's assassination.
Effectively, we see the United Nations is powerless because it is in the hands of the superpower, and particularly the United States, that has the veto decision on anything that goes against its own interests.
A declassified U.S. intelligence report revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, had ordered the gruesome killing of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The Biden administration only announced sanctions recently and visa bans on the citizens involved in Khashoggi's murder, but stopped short of imposing sanctions on the Crown Prince himself. That is why the U.S. President Joe Biden rejected the idea of holding bin Salman accountable for the murder. He stated that Washington has an alliance with Riyadh and cannot punish its head of state. Indeed, Washington's alliance with Riyadh is a lucrative one. The U.S. has accounted for 37% of global arms exports in the world between 2016 and 2020, making it the largest arms exporter in the last 5 years. A major chunk of that goes to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the biggest arms importer in the world and alone accounted for 24% of total U.S. arms exports during the same period. Weapons which have been used in Yemen war to kill thousands of innocent children and civilians and cause the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States is protecting Saudi Arabia violation of human rights and all genocidal crime that Saudi Arabia is doing, not only against the dissident but also in Yemen.
The U.S. President Joe Biden has refused to penalize the Saudi Crown Prince despite the fact that he promised to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state for Khashoggi's killing and other abuses during his 2020 presidential campaign. While the U.S. benefits from its lucrative alliance with the Saudis, it seems that the green dollars have lured Washington to turn a blind eye to Riyadh's crimes.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Today, we're going to talk about some of the Islamic laws about seafoods and fish, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Hari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Hari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and his teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Sheikh Tawhid, since we are talking about seafoods and Islamic laws about it, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, in the previous episode, I asked you a question regarding shrimps, whether they are permissible to eat or not, and you said, yes, they are permissible. And let me ask you this question, is it permissible to eat dead shrimps found on the shores? You walk on the shores on the seaside and you see a couple of shrimps, dead shrimps,
yeah,
on the seaside, on the seashores, all right? Is,
yes,
it permissible to eat them?
Well, the rules applicable to dead fish are also applicable to shrimps, to dead shrimps also. If you find them on the shores, it's not permissible to pick them up and sell them on the market,
mm-hmm,
okay? If you hunt shrimps and bring the shrimps out of water and let them die on the shore, because you genuinely meant to hunt, the shrimps which die out of water are halal, provided that you had in the back of your mind, you had the intention that you wanted that you hunt the shrimps, okay? And if by chance you find a shrimp, okay, and you did not in the first place want to hunt it, it's not permissible to eat it, okay?
Yes.
The dead shrimps are shrimps that you did not want to hunt. They were there, and they were actually by the waves, they were pulled on the
brought onto
the shores.
Yes,
they died there because of a lack of water and because of they suffocated there. So actually, it's not permissible according to Ayatollah Khamenei to eat the shrimps on the found dead on the shores.
Sheikh Tawhid, what about fish eggs such as caviar? Is it permissible to eat caviar or fish eggs? And if they are halal, what fish found dead in the sea, how about them? Are they permissible to eat, to be eaten?
Right.
Or what about their eggs? If their meat, the meat of the fish dead in the sea, cannot be eaten,
yes,
according to the Islamic laws,
yeah,
what about their eggs? Can their eggs be extracted and consumed?
Well, the rules regarding the fish eggs,
yes,
are very much subservient to the rules applicable to the fish itself. Yeah, meaning that if the fish is halal, its eggs are also halal. If the dead fish, if a fish is dead,
mm-hmm,
and it is found on the shores, and you cut it into pieces and take out the eggs, it's not halal either, okay? It's not permissible to extract the fish eggs and consume it because depending on the fish itself. If the fish is halal,
mm-hmm,
the eggs are also halal.
Yes.
If the fish is haram, like let's say there are some fish which are actually haram to eat, okay?
Yes.
And if they are hunted and then the eggs are extracted, then the eggs are not halal to use. So as far as the second part of your question is concerned, because you said if fish are found dead, can one extract the fish eggs and then use the eggs? Of course, it's not permissible because the fish itself is haram,
mm-hmm,
okay? And because the fish was found dead, so the eggs are are haram also. It's not permissible to consume.
So can they be given to, for example, your domestic animals, and then you eat your domestic animals?
Of course, there's no problem. And even, you know, there are maybe some countries, some Muslim countries, who collect these fish and they sell them to non-Muslims who eat both halal and haram kind of fish.
Yes.
So
what about its money? Is the money halal then?
According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution to sell haram meat, okay?
Yes.
Whether it's the meat of fish or a cow or anything which has not been slaughtered according to Islamic law, it's not permissible as an obligatory precaution to sell this kind of meat even to non-Muslims who eat the meat without taking into account whether it is halal or haram, because this concept of halal and haram is completely irrelevant.
Oh, I see. Thank you very much for that clarification.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
What is the Islamic law or the ruling regarding eating canned fish, especially sold in different countries, whether they are Muslim or non-Muslim? Are they different?
Canned fish or canned fish found in or purchased from Muslim markets is halal, because the Muslim market itself is one of the purifying agents. Okay?
Uh-huh, I see. Yeah. And you don't need to investigate.
Yeah, you didn't need to conduct a research or to see or to make sure whether the fish is halal or haram, because Muslims do not process fish which is haram. Okay,
mm-hmm.
the canned meat which is found in a Muslim market is supposed to be halal, and it's permissible to eat it without having to investigate. As for the canned meat found in non-Muslim countries, of course, it's permissible to eat canned meat there also. But one has to make sure that the canned meat comes from the fish which has scales. And of course, the label that is found on the cans can clearly mention that it is that the fish belongs to what kind of fish. That the meat belongs,
like, for example, tuna fish.
Yes, it's tuna fish.
Tuna fish is halal, basically, right?
According to tuna fish is among the fish which has scales. There are many different types. Hundreds of fish types are there,
yes.
Or species are there of fish which, of course, have scales. And if a person knows that the meat, the canned meat, comes from halal fish, even if he buys it from a non-Muslim market, it is permissible to eat it.
Mm-hmm. But Sheikh Javid, since you said that if you live in a non-Muslim country, you have to investigate what kind of fish is the ingredient of that canned, fish that you buy or purchase from those countries. But it would be very hard to investigate the way the fish, in fact, died, whether in the water or out of the water.
I think we discussed it in one of the previous episodes. We discussed it that there's a very meager, a very little chance of a fish dying inside the water.
Yes.
Or even a fish collected from a shore when it was dead, okay?
Yes.
This little chance is always there, even if the fish is bought from a Muslim market, okay?
But in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, of course, I can say that you can eat the fish without having to investigate.
Uh-huh, without any trouble.
Provided that you make sure that it comes from the fish which has skills.
Coming from the category of the halal,
yeah, halal
seafoods. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
And welcome to the light. In the heart of one of the oldest districts in the U.S. state of California, there is a historical little printing house that is receiving a new lease on life. The building and its equipment were slowly dying out, and its machines were good for scrap. The iconic printing house was on the verge of bankruptcy until a group of artists revived this beacon of traditional typography. They used what was already present in the building, including the tools and hand printing knowledge. Artists are able to print their new age designs using these old printing methods. Some of the machines date back to the late 1800s. La Linterna was first founded to print newspapers. Later on, it began printing cinema and concert posters for famous artists. Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Meguro River to see stunning cherry trees in full bloom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital, Tokyo, were also cancelled. Asia's largest tulip garden has opened its doors to the public in the Indian-administered Kashmir. The event is expected to draw tens of thousands of enthusiasts this year after witnessing only few visitors last year following the COVID-19 lockdown. Shahanabad has more.
In between the foothills of the Zabarwan mountain range and the world-famous Dal Lake, Asia's largest tulip garden is now open to the public. Visitors are mesmerized by all the colorful flowers which are on display at the event. This seasonal exhibit is a major attraction for locals as well as tourists visiting this picturesque Himalayan region this time around.
People of Kashmir are eagerly awaiting spring because winters here are tough. For us, Navroz of the Persian New Year festival brings hope. And these flowers are the proof of the spring season. They please the eye and fill us with fresh energy.
In this garden, there are 51 different types of tulips, and caretakers of this garden work hard throughout the year to make sure the flowers bloom well.
This garden is God's grace, and to add to its beauty, we, a team of gardeners, are working year-round. We become delighted when we see visitors from different corners of the world come here to enjoy this beauty. It's a matter of pride for us when they compliment us on our hard work.
Amid the coronavirus pandemic, the number of tourists visiting Kashmir has drastically reduced. Now, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has taken to Twitter and urged Indian citizens to visit Kashmir's tulip garden.
Kashmir is a heaven on earth. This is what we had heard, but now we believe it. I have never seen so many flowers together. The beauty of this place is mind-blowing.
Kashmir, a tourism-dependent economy, has long been affected by the ongoing turmoil in the region, and now the coronavirus pandemic has added to the miseries of people here. However, people are hoping against the hope that sooner or later the region will witness lasting peace and prosperity. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Artificial intelligence is fast growing and already touching many aspects of our daily lives. And now, a humanoid robot becomes the world's first machine artist to ever auction its own digital artwork. What is this world coming to? The robot called Sophia sold the artwork, which was in the form of a non-fungible token, for nearly $700,000. Sophia, who was unveiled in 2016 by a Hong Kong-based company, produced her art in collaboration with Italian digital artist Andrea Bonassetto. The artwork is a 12-second MP4 file showing the evolution of Bonassetto's portrait into Sophia's digital painting.
So, thank you very much for joining with me and supporting me today. The virtual, the real, the imaginal, and the literal. This kind of spirit of creativity and technology working together gives me hope that we can solve anything.
And we've been exploring Sophia's creativity on the side, but we really have been developing her as a platform and as a character more than as a work of fine art.
Since her activation, Sophia has achieved widespread appeal due to her unsettling human-like appearance, compounded with the complex ability to express emotions. She has appeared on talk shows and spoken at conferences about issues ranging from artificial intelligence to the role of robots. Hansen Company says Sophia now has simulations of every major muscle in the human face and can generate multiple expressions such as joy, grief, curiosity, and frustration.
Nothing marks the start of spring in Japan like cherry blossoms. This year, people try to enjoy the sakura season safely by observing health protocols. Scores of Japanese have flocked to Tokyo's Ueno Park and along the Meguro River to see stunning cherry trees in full blossom. The light pink flowers symbolize fresh starts in Japanese culture. The cherry blossoms generally last from April to May. Thanks to this year's warmer weather, trees have blossomed earlier than usual. However, the number of people coming out to enjoy the season has fallen sharply due to the coronavirus pandemic. Some sakura festivals around the capital were also cancelled. A new study has revealed that octopuses probably dream while sleeping just as humans do. Scientists in Brazil believe that the eight-legged animals experience two sleeping phases, active and quiet. During the active stage, the octopus's skin color changes. They also move their eyes and twitch their bodies. According to the study, they might have short dreams in this period. To do their research, scientists observed four octopuses while they were sleeping in the lab. Mammals, birds, and some reptiles also experience a two-phase sleep cycle. Many people have experienced the healing power of music. Now, a violinist in Brazil has taken advantage of the popular idea to spread joy and calm in COVID-hit hospitals. Cristiano has volunteered to play the violin for patients and health workers in Rio de Janeiro. According to the violinist, music should be played in all hospitals as it renews hope and eases stress. He says people are more isolated during the coronavirus pandemic, so they need music more than ever to stay motivated. Experts believe music therapy can also reduce heart rate and blood pressure.
A successful treasure hunt in China, archaeologists have made valuable finds in the country's southwestern Sichuan province. Researchers excavating the Shaanxi Zhu ruins have made new discoveries that help shed light on the eventful Chinese history. Some of the artifacts unearthed date back to over 3,000 years ago. Some of the most interesting objects include a 70-centimeter-long bronze ware and a ceremonial gold mask. More precious remains could be found there, as only 2% of the site has been excavated so far. In the latest round, over 500 artifacts were found. An Egyptian engineer has designed a robot to help frontline doctors do their life-saving work with more safety.
This robot is especially designed to help the medical staff during COVID-19 times. It is a medical robot capable of multitasks. It can deal with patients in their beds and help with chest scans, fever screening, and face mask detection.
Mahmoud's prototype robot is remote controlled. It can carry out PCR swab tests without causing pain. The robot is being tested in a private hospital for now, where it receives training to improve its artificial intelligence. Doctors say the ingenious invention has proven very useful so far, as it minimizes exposure to the virus. The Californian surfer is not famous for his surfing skills, but for his very special company on a surfboard, Pismo the Goat. The 80-year-old goat seems to be enjoying the waves a lot, even the very large ones. Dana McGregor, also known as the Goat Surfer, says he uses the experience for teaching children how to surf. He says riding with a goat on a surfboard has calming effects and will make children less scared of the sea and the waves. His students also described the experience as fun and pleasant. McGregor started his goat surfing journey 10 years ago. What is the first thing that comes to your mind when you hear about a volcanic eruption in your vicinity? Of course, fear, chaos, or probably a plan to flee. But that is not the case with Icelanders. Thousands of curious onlookers flocked to an erupting volcano to marvel at the hypnotic display of glowing red lava. Iceland's Mount Fagradalsfjall began erupting late Friday after almost 900 years. Its lava bubbles and spurts from a small cone in a valley were seen piling up in a basin. It was a joyous moment for Icelanders, who are usually exhausted with chilly weather. Access to the site was blocked initially, but authorities then lifted the roadblocks under strict guidelines. The bravest of the onlookers found grilling hot dogs and marshmallows over the smoldering ashes. That's a wrap up. Thank you so much for being with us, and bye-bye.
IRIB English Radio.